Public Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. To devoted public radio listeners, the name Maz Jobrani might sound familiar. The Iranian-American comedian is one of the revolving group of regular panelists on the NPR quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. But while the reach of that show is impressive, by the time Jobrani made his first appearance, he had already performed stand-up comedy for audiences across the United States, to Europe, to the Middle East. Jobrani draws on everything from international politics to his children to growing older for his material, which will be on display later this month at Milwaukee's Turner Hall Ballroom. We reached him in Los Angeles, where he was busy icing a sports injury to his ankles. Maz Jobrani, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
What do you think it takes for people to find you funny in both the United States and in the Middle East?
I think it takes jokes. You know, it's interesting. That's a good question. You know, what's been interesting is the stuff that works here often works there. And I think a big reason is, given the internet and just how small the world has become just from media, you know, you can go to Saudi Arabia and do a joke about Lindsay Lohan, and they'll be like, oh, that Lindsay, always in the rehab, you know. So I think it translates pretty well nowadays. And it's not just with me. There's a lot of American comedians that have been going over there and finding a fan base that's waiting and ready to laugh.
Well, and it's funny because I don't think a lot of people in this country imagine the Middle East as a place where people are going to comedy shows.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It's not like, obviously, it's not as common as it is here. Like, every town here has a comedy club. But over there, there's about, you know, in the different countries, each country has probably a handful of promoters that will bring in different comedians and do one big, let's say like three or four big events a year. And usually they'll bring a headliner from the States or a couple of headliners from the States, and then they'll put up a few local guys. And what's interesting is the whole scene seemed to have started when I went out when we did the Access of Evil comedy tour with me, Ahmed Ahmed, and Aaron Cater, and Dino Bidala was with us as well, but he didn't make it to that Middle East tour. But when we first went out to the Middle East and did it, we did five countries. We did Egypt, Lebanon, the UAE, Kuwait, and
Was it Jordan?
Jordan. It was Jordan, exactly. And so when we went out there, most of the cities when we were performing, we would do like a little talent show beforehand and give an opening spot to a local. And people started showing up. And there was a handful of guys who had already been doing it, but it just wasn't as a big of a scale as it is now. And now when you look out there, all of these places have a lot of young comics who, like I said, will perform whenever somebody comes to town. Sometimes they'll put on their own shows. So there's a scene that's starting to happen slowly but surely, but there's a scene.
Do you think the audiences in the Middle East were appreciative of your coming there and doing your thing in a way that, you know, when you do, you're just another night on the, you know, on the bill in Los Angeles or Cleveland or Milwaukee? Is there a difference between the kind of reaction you get?
Yeah, I think they were even more appreciative because no one, you know, before we went out to the Middle East, this was 2007. So before we went out there to do those shows, usually when American comedians went out to the region to perform, it was for the American troops. So we were the first group of guys who actually went out to perform for the people of the Middle East. And it was amazing. I said when we first did our shows, if you would have asked me, like when we were first doing it in the U.S., if you would have said, where do you think you'll be performing outside the U.S. a year from now? I would have said, you know, England, Canada, Australia, the English-speaking countries. I honestly didn't even know there was an audience in the Middle East that understood English well enough to get this. And like I said, about maybe a year later, we got a call from some guys out of Jordan, and they said, yes, fella, we would like for you to come do your show in Jordan. And I was like, bro, I'd love to, but you know, the show's in English. And he was like, yeah, I'm speaking English to you right now, you idiot. And I was like, oh, yeah. And it was an eye-opener. And it was amazing because it almost was like this audience had been looking for us because there'd been so much negativity about Middle Easterners and Muslims in the media, and it was this relief when they found us because they just were like, oh wow, these guys are talking about everything that we're going through. And so yeah, with those audiences in the Middle East, it for them, because they couldn't go to a comedy club every night of the week, And they were going to special events. It was an event. It was a big to do. You know, they get dressed up, they come out, they're excited. So they were really, really excited, and they continue to be. Anytime I've gone out to do shows again, I've been on a couple of solo tours, and they continue to come out, and they're just really amped for the whole event.
There is this truly funny video you produced about racist and misdirected racist sloganeering called My Two Worlds, Go Home Arab, or maybe it's Go Home Arab.
Yeah.
Is it wrong to assume that this was inspired by stuff you have heard in this country throughout your life?
Yeah, I think it was inspired by things I heard in my life. And the idea of that show was actually, that was going to be a pilot for a webisode that I wanted to do that we kind of, we got sidetracked and never got around to doing it. But maybe we'll visit it again. But the idea was, first of all, racism is stupid and it's on its own. But then you when you see the ignorance that comes with it sometimes, for example, when after September 11th, people were going around shooting Indian Sikhs.
Right.
Just because they had turbans. And they go, wait a minute, you're not even doing the research to gear your hate towards the right group. And also that group didn't do anything. I've experienced it firsthand coming from Iran as a 6-year-old to America, and then seeing the racism against Iranians when the hostage situation happened, the racism that was happening here. You know, I had a kid that used to call me an effing Iranian because that's what people called you back then. What was interesting was they never took the time to sit there and think, wait a minute, you're in America and you actually fled this regime that took the hostages. So therefore, you're against the regime as much as I am, or maybe even more so. But they didn't think about that. They just thought, oh, you're Iranian as opposed to Iranian, and I'm going to pick on you and beat you up and whatever it was. So, the misled racism, there's plenty of it, so this becomes plenty of material to play with.
It does take something, though, to be able to laugh at it as opposed to just repeatedly banging your forehead into the desk in front of you.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think that's the point. I think driving home the point, I think making a point through comedy can be a lot more efficient and a lot more effective, I should say, because sometimes the guy who's being made fun of has to realize how dumb he is being by doing what he's doing.
You have a live performance called I Come in Peace, which I will also point out is truly funny. But why did you record it in Sweden, of all places?
You know, it's interesting. It goes back to what I was saying about the comedy now, that you can do comedy around the world. First of all, there's a lot of Iranians in Sweden. I guess they had a very open immigration policy. So a lot of Iranians that were fleeing the regime ended up there. And so when the time came, I decided to do a tour in the Scandinavian countries, and it was Sweden and Norway. That's where we started, and then I've gone to the other ones since. I went to Holland and Belgium and Denmark. Yes, so I've been in that region. But Sweden, what was amazing, Stockholm in itself is such an international place. And when I went out there, you know, the Iranians came out, the Swedes came out, other people came out, and I felt like it was this electric audience. And one of the things that I love is sometimes when you do shows, like when I do shows in places that are major cities, what I love is people coming to these shows that have an understanding or at least some knowledge of the world, because I'll inevitably talk about different countries and different experiences in those different countries. So when you go to a place like Sweden, Europeans seem to be a lot more aware of this world politics, and it just felt like a great place to have an audience that got what you were talking about. So I said, you know what, let's go back and try it. And I was so happy because in my act, when I'll say like, hey, are there any Pakistanis here? Are there any Russians here? Are there any of whatever? I wasn't sure how many were going to be in the audience in Sweden. I thought it might be just Swedes and Iranians, but it ended up there was, you know, one Russian, one Pakistani, one Palestinian, one Jewish guy. It was exactly what I needed for my act. So it worked out.
So if I have my chronology right, you lived in Iran for just 6 years before you moved to this country where you grew up. Do you feel like you have insights into being Iranian, or is it really about the Iranian-American experience?
I think that I'm probably more of an expert on the Iranian-American experience. You know, I actually experienced my lack of insight about Iran when I went and visited about 15, 16 years ago. And I felt almost like a stranger in my country of my birth, because I didn't know where I was. I didn't know where I was going. They kind of can tell that you've just come from the U.S. Even though I speak Farsi fluently, I think that I felt different than everybody. And I felt different culturally. I feel like, culturally speaking, the American culture of just the individual has kind of set in me a little bit. Not that I don't still, hold my family close, but I think Iranians hold their families even closer. It's like, your cousin lives across the street, your other cousin's next door, your mother's in the next room, your uncle's underneath. I mean, they're just surrounded family-wise, and I feel like I've become a little, even though, well, my mother's 15 minutes away. There you go. So I've got her. I've got a little bit of distance.
In this country, being close is being on speed dial.
Exactly. And that's actually what's been interesting is, like, I had to grow through that. Like, as a kid, I would see the a lot of my American friends and just the way they were with their mother or father, whether it was like, oh, you're 18, see you later. Whereas with my family, it was like, you're 18, what's the rush? Hang out, wait till you're 40. So I feel like when I went back, I really felt that difference, the cultural difference, the fact that I'm not that knowledgeable of the country and the experience of Iran as I am about being Iranian in America.
It's funny, as you say this, I mean, I remember I must have been, 15 or 16 and being someplace and, kissing my dad on the cheek goodbye when he was going someplace and I was going someplace else and being approached by, it was a Middle Easterner who said how unusual it was to see someone in this country he thought it was a really Middle Eastern thing to do.
Absolutely, and it is, and that's the other thing. I mean, it's just interesting. Middle Easterners, we're always kissing each other's cheeks. We're, I feel that the culturally speaking, it's a lot warmer a culture than the American culture. And there are parts of America where you feel like, oh, I got I got a lot of the hospitality is at another level. Like you hear like Southern hospitality and the sort. But in our cultures, I mean, it's amazing. Like, whenever my American friends would come over, they'd be shocked at the lengths to which my mother or grandfather or whoever was home at the time would go to, like, bringing out the fruit and plates and food. And we might just be coming in for a minute to, grab our tennis rackets to go play tennis. But it was like, hey, there's a guest in the house. It was like a fire drill. It's like, get everything out, Whereas the opposite for me, when I would go to my friend's house and we'd just be very casual, we'd walk in and nobody would say anything, and then finally you'd say, hey, can I get some water? They'd be like, yeah, it's in the kitchen. Go over there, make a left, go ahead and help yourself. And that was just not part of our culture, It's interesting to see that, and like you said, once in a while when I'll see an American do something like kissing the cheek, or maybe when you come to their house, they bring all the fruit out or whatever, I always got to go, wow, where did you grow up? And sometimes I've actually run into people who say, yeah, I grew up out of the country. I grew up in the Middle East. I was a military child or whatever. And I just kind of picked up the culture. So they're very different. And there's these little things like this, but it's definitely, I think that in the Middle Eastern culture, the family is so important and the hospitality and all that. And whereas I think in the Western culture, the individual, and there's good and bad from both. I think that there's something to be taken from both of those.
Absolutely. Well, so let me shift gears briefly. How did the gig on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me come about?
So Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is an interesting one. I used to play soccer on Saturdays before I hurt my Achilles heel. But I would listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on the way home always. And I remember hearing Sarah Silverman as the call-in guest one time. And I thought, oh, that would be cool to do this. And so one day, I don't know how it happened, but my agents called and they said, hey, do you want to be a call-in guest for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me? I was like, are you kidding me? I was like, of course. And they didn't know that I'd wanted to, but I think that what had happened was Wait, Wait was looking to add some new panelists, and I think they were looking at comedians. And so then they had me as a call-in guest the first time, and that was fun. And then they go, hey, they want to see if you want to do it. I go, of course I want to do it. And then the first time I did it, I was so excited about it. I was actually on a vacation in Hawaii with my wife and my son, who was 2.5 at the time. And we were there with some friends. And the plan had been we were going to go there and stay with our friends for a few days and then fly back, land at LAX at like 6 in the morning. I was going to drive, have my wife take the kid and go home, and I was going to get on another plane and keep going. And we're in Hawaii having a great time, and my friend says, dude, where are you going? Like, you could stay. We have this place for another few days. Just stay. And I go, no, I'm doing Wait, Don't Tell Me. And he's like, yeah, but can't you just do it another time? I go, you don't get it. This is Wait, Don't Tell Me. And I was so excited, I blew off an extended stay in Hawaii so I could go do Wait, Don't Tell Me.
And see, if this had been, you know, maybe 10 years before, you could have had your car intentionally break down to do Car Talk.
Yeah. There you go, man. Whatever it takes. Whatever it takes to get on these shows.
Well, hey, this is pledge drive season here, so that is a positively perfect story to have you tell to remind people why it's important to support their local public radio station.
Absolutely, man. I gave up Hawaii. You guys can give up $5 a month or $10 or whatever.
Maz Jobrani, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch. Appreciate it.
Comedian Maz Jobrani will do a show at Milwaukee's Turner Hall Ballroom next Thursday. Next on the program, if you were on the sidelines for the recent races like the Lakefront and Chicago Marathons, but you're wondering what it would take to run in one someday, we'll learn what training opportunities exist in Milwaukee. Keep listening. This is Lake Effect on listener-supported WUWM.